Okay, good morning. Continuing the morning session, this session 9 is focused on energy storage demonstrations. We have 4 speakers, and as has been the practice throughout the meeting, we will hold questions until the end of the session, and we will have questions for everyone at once. So let me introduce the first speaker, Jared Hornberger. Will speak on commercialization of silicon carbide power modules. And Jared is from Arkansas Power Electronics International. Jared.
All right. Thank you. So I know there's a wide background here. I'll try and keep it as simple and as detailed as possible so that we get the message across. I've got a couple intro slides on silicon carbide as a semiconductor technology. So some of you are probably very familiar with it. Some of you may not be. We'll talk about some of the applications that silicon carbide is going into and talk about the role that Arkansas Power Electronics plays in silicon carbide. And then we have a DOE Phase 3 accelerator program that we've received, and so we'll overview that program here and talk about the commercialization of silicon carbide power modules. The HT2000 module is one that we're working on. We'll talk about the manufacturing facilities that we've set up to produce this in volume and some of the reliability testing and kind of wrap up with some conclusions. So first of all, silicon carbide is a wide bandgap material. If you look at the chart there on the left, we have 3. We have silicon, gallium nitride, and silicon carbide. And so gallium and nitride and silicon carbide are considered wide bandgap materials because they have a very large bandgap compared to silicon. that means that we have lower intrinsic carriers, and that means we can operate at very high temperatures. So theoretically, silicon carbide can operate at 600 degrees C versus silicon standard operating temperature is in the 150 to 175 range. Breakdown. the higher critical fields in silicon carbide by an order of magnitude relate to higher blocking voltages, lower on resistances, which that relates to less losses in the system, and higher switching speeds. The material itself has a very high thermal conductivity, if you look at the mechanical properties, which means we can dissipate heat from the device a lot quicker and a lot more of it, so we can have very power-dense systems. As an example, I've got here on the top left is a standard solar inverter that you can buy. It's with silicon IGBT technology. It's a 5-kilowatt inverter. The one below it is one that we've built at Arkansas Power Electronics. Has very similar specs. It's also 5 kilowatts. But we've used silicon carbide power devices instead of silicon. And so you can see some of the advantages. So the volume is 7 times smaller. The weight is 8 times lighter. The temperature, the junction temperature of the device, we can operate 2 times higher than a standard IGBT. And we have higher efficiency as well, peak efficiency in the system. Some of the applications that we're looking at, motor drives for hybrid and fully electric vehicles, both for commercial and military applications, also electric aircraft applications. Power converters, if you look around at any electronic system, it probably has a power converter in it. Some of the things that we're targeting are grid tie inverters for solar and wind, downhole instrumentation for geological exploration, as well as power converters for aerospace. These are some of the initial applications, but there's many, many, many applications. We also have high voltage applications because silicon carbide can block much higher voltages. So we're working on fault current limiters, for example, to replace mechanical circuit breakers. And then for the very high temperature operation, we can go into places where we haven't been before, so in power turbines or jet engines. So APEI, or Arkansas Power Electronics, we're a small business, and we've grown our business around power electronic system and advancing power electronic systems. mostly using silicon carbide. We can also use gallium nitride and others. So our main focus is power modules. We'll talk a little bit more about power modules. You can see a picture in the bottom in the middle of a power module. Device packaging there on the left, and then power electronic systems. So the one on the right is a power electronics module with an integrated gate driver, so more of a system level. To overview, this is kind of a busy slide, but it summarizes our phase three program and where it fits in to this technology. So that technology actually started with a phase one SBIR in 2005. There we built a single phase 3-kilowatt inverter and demonstrated it at high temperature. That led into a phase two, which we then built a 10-kilowatt system and demonstrated the advantages that we could gain from silicon carbide. And so in that system, we were able to achieve 98.5% efficiency. and then that work led into some commercial interest. So you see in the middle, in 2007 to 2009, we started work with Rome Semiconductor, who was very interested in this technology, and we built this power module with the integrated gate driver. It's a 50-kilowatt module, and it operates at high temperature. And we also received an R&D 100 award for that module. That work also stemmed into some other interest from commercial partners. In 2010 to 2011, there on the chart, SAIC came to us, was very interested in developing a power brick type module, something very close to what you would find in standard silicon type packages. Only they wanted to take advantages of silicon carbide and reduce the losses and increase the operating temperature. And so that work led into this back into this DOE Phase 3 program is where we want to commercialize this product. We have a very good product, and we want to commercialize it. So the steps we're taking to do that is facilities expansion. So we need to be able to have the facilities to manufacture these modules in volume. And then the product qualification. So we're constantly working on improving reliability. So we're doing a lot of component testing and module testing, and then manufacturing and sales in our commercialization process. And so we've already sold engineering samples of these modules and continue to sell them as we continue to work on this commercialization path. So just a quick overview of the module itself that we're proposing to commercialize here is a 1,200-volt, 150-amp rating. That 150-amp depends on the devices. So we recently built a module that can handle 1,000 amps with larger devices. The packaging is capable of withstanding 250 degrees C, and we use custom materials such as high-temperature plastics and metal matrix composite base plates. It's a very low-profile module, so it's less than a half-inch thick compared to standard brick modules that you see that will be an inch and a half or so thick. So a quick overview of the facilities. We have two Class 1000 clean rooms that we've built out. The first one is for power substrate. So you may be somewhat familiar with this, or you may be familiar with the printed circuit board technology. For power electronics, we need to handle high currents and high voltages, and so we use a ceramic substrate that has thick sheets of copper laminated on either side. And this lab is designed to process that and make our circuit patterns. And so we'll laminate with a photoresist, we'll expose with UV light, and run it through the ChemCut equipment. You can see a picture of the ChemCut equipment there on the right, and that will develop and etch the metal traces. And there we get the basis for our power electronics modules, which is the substrates. That leads into the assembly line. Again, a Class 1000 clean room. And we have the assembly equipment that we need to assemble power modules. So we have a plasma oven, and we have a couple different options for reflow. We have a vacuum reflow where we can get void-free, very good contacts with our die attach and our substrate attach. We have a batch reflow oven where we do our solder paste applications. Wire bonding is next, and then we also have a lid sealing technology. So we're able to seal the pictures on the top right are metal packages. We're able to hermetically seal those in a nitrogen atmosphere. So many, many capabilities in this line for assembling power modules. I'll note that we're ISO certified and aerospace certified. We received that back in June. An example of two of the components to give you show you what we do for component testing. The one on the left is testing encapsulation. So this is a material that we coat the devices with after we assemble the module to protect it from high voltage arcing or breakdown. And so here is a material that we've specified for use at high temperature. We've done several tests in these little packages you can see, and the results of this test, after a few hundred cycles, most every one of these developed cracks in it. And so we went back to the manufacturer and then back to other methods, and we're doing another test to continue on to get further reliability out of encapsulation. The technology on the right is for substrates. And so here you can see a picture of direct bond copper substrates. The metal has peeled off the ceramic. That happened just after 100 thermal cycles. We're also testing at the same time direct bond aluminum substrates and active metal brazed copper substrates, which are passing all of our tests to this point. The ones we're using actually in the module are the active metal brazed, and so we're pretty confident in that component. Overall, testing as a module, we want to do some accelerated life testing, but it's hard to do for something that's operating at high temperatures. So we were able to find a chamber from Qualmark that will operate from a range of minus 100 degrees C to plus 250 degrees C and can provide a vibration up to 75 G's at the same time. And so this unit is at our facilities. The walls have been built up around it, and we're in the process of plumbing and hooking it up now. And so we'll be soon testing full modules under full load conditions and be able to reach some reliability data sooner than we can with our individual component testing. So to wrap it up, we've talked about silicon carbide electronics and the benefits that we can get from silicon carbide over the standard technology today. We've talked about the Phase 3 accelerator program that we have under Dr. Emery Zhuk and the commercialization path for our HT2000 modules, which includes the facilities, which we've talked about, process optimization, reliability testing, and product sales. The funding for this project is from our own funds is over $1 million, from the state of Arkansas, $500,000, and from this DOE Phase 3, another $500,000. So we've got a very good collaboration to commercialization of these power modules. So the current status is that we've completed the facilities. They're built out. The processes are set up. We've fabricated modules, and we've sold engineering samples of these modules. And we're still in component testing and getting ready to do entire module testing for reliability. So if you want to look at the big picture, the overall impact on power electronic systems, it has the potential to increase efficiency. We've proved that in several cases. Reduce volume and weight, and reduce the cooling or eliminate the cooling. If nothing else, the cooling size can be reduced. And then there's a overall cost savings to this technology as well. So that, I'd like to thank Dr. Emery Zhuk for funding this program, and thank you for your attention.
Let's see, the second talk this morning will be given by Dr. Michael Nahonkin. Michael is from Energy Storage and Power, LLC, and he will speak to us about second-generation compressed air energy storage technology. Michael.
Thank you. I will give you a presentation which is practically the same presentations as I did at Energy Storage Forum in Tokyo. In Tokyo, I was given 45 minutes. Today, I was given 15 minutes. Therefore, I will be very brief. And if you have any questions, I will be more than happy to talk to you and give you a lot of details. Does not move? Okay. I will start with the first project, which we built in 1991, started in 1986. It is Alabama project, 110 megawatt, which was started on June 1st, 1988, and finished on June 1st, 1991. You see this picture, and you can see right now it is just Alabama project. It will be very fast. That we have compressors, expanders, if you can see, a motor generator, clutches on both sides, and high and low pressure combustors, intercoolers, recuperator, and underground storage. This was very sophisticated cycle. It's cycle of combustion turbine, which never was built before and never was built after, because it had combustion turbine with intercooled compressors, high and low pressure combustors, recuperator, and operations were that during off-peak hours, we disconnected this clutch. We used off-peak energy available and not needed. We drove compressor and converted off-peak energy in energy of stored air. During power, during daytime, during power generation needs, we used compressed air, preheated in recuperator up to 500 degree F, and then it was preheated in high pressure, low pressure combustor, and 110 megawatt was delivered during peak hours. This was optimized for very specific customer requirements. It was many years ago, and they had coal-fired plant in Alabama, and during night times they shut down this coal-fired plant or run at maybe 10% load. During daytime, they were buying very expensive peaking energy. And therefore, they gave us challenge, and we conducted this optimization. Therefore, it is was very sophisticated cycle, with cycle sophisticated up several new components. For example, combustors were far away from typical combustors of combustion turbines by parameters, by specific operations. We have recuperator, and we have this plant optimized and integrated based on power requirements and also based on very close cooperation with Phoenix and Sisson company, who gave us cost quotations in order for us to optimize overall plant based on overall plant performance, cost, delivery, part load operation, and so on. ESPC developed this patent, this project based on our patents. We optimized, conducted conceptual engineering, selected prime components, and selected Gibson Hill and Herbert Company. They presented EPC contract for delivery of this project. And the customer hired Burson McDonald Company, which conducted excellent operations because they ensured that all these projects were delivered on EPC basis, meeting all performance, cost, and timing data, including part load operations, which are very restricted by unique components. As I mentioned, high and low pressure combustor, slightly upgraded low pressure expander by 200 degree. Typical industrial expanders have temperature 1300 degree. We increased to 1500 degree. But practically, it is extremely successful project, and it's still in operation. And they operate approximately 1,600 hours a year in already more than 20 years. But time changed. By the way, this is our this is picture which was taken in 1988 when we started this project, and this we concluded. By the way, EPRI was prime contributor, very big contributor to execution of this project. They had financial investment, and Dr. Schenker was and other EPRI people were involved in sitting behind customer, and were involved in insurance that project was delivered properly. I mentioned to you that after we develop EPC had EPC proposal, our company had technical supervision of project execution. We looked at this and we saw that project was done properly. Moving forward, that right now time changed. Right now, before I told you, we try to address very specific issue, how to run coal-fired plant and how to run them during off-peak hours, and how to convert this energy during peak hours. Right now we have renewable energy, smart grids, with a lot of flexibility to meet different sizes, operations. It's a lot of flexibilities. Therefore, we developed and patented second generation of CASE technology. Second generation of CASE technology consists of standard, this is motor-driven standard skid-mounted compressors. And these compressors serve to meet and to store not used renewable energy and to meet smart grid requirements during off-peak hours. We can select a variety of sizes, variety of number of these compressors. And this compressor properly optimized based on economic analysis, and everywhere often conducts this analysis. And we actually select these compressors which use off-peak energy, smart grid, renewable energy, and store, convert this energy in energy of stored air. During power generation, we have two components during power generation, combustion turbine. Here is 7EA combustion turbine. And bottoming cycle, I don't know if I can point out, bottoming cycle green expanders. What does it mean that combustion turbine usually has 40% of total capacity, 227 megawatt? We don't burn fuel only. You don't see this, yeah? It doesn't work. Okay, we burn fuel. Can I use my? Do you have a pointer? Oh, thank you. Oh, it's much better. We will burn fuel only in combustion turbine, a low NOx combustor with minimum NOx emissions, and we are utilizing exhaust heat of combustion turbine to preheat stored air. Air is preheated here, and air is expanded through bottoming cycle expanders. Also, we have huge responsibility to optimize these expanders by size, by numbers of expanders, and practically, these expanders represent 65% of overall capacity, 227 megawatt based on this specific combustion turbine. It is green energy, and heat rate of combustion turbine is reduced from 10,000 BTU per kilowatt hour to 3,800 BTU per kilowatt hour, which is extremely low. Emissions also de facto is reduced because if we have, let's say, 9 ppm emissions and exit of combustion turbine, there are no emissions because we don't burn any fuel. And therefore, practically, if you look at overall, our emissions reduced by a factor of 3. It could not be accepted in different states, but de facto, actually, emissions are much lower. Therefore, this plant has a lot of flexibility for meeting renewable energy, smart grid requirements. We're involved. We have only standard skid-mounted off-shell components, and we can select any size, which is start with selection of combustion turbine. Combustion turbine represents approximately 40% of requested capacity. We're free to optimize. We have no restriction to be optimized for any underground storage. Because let's say in Alabama project, we had high pressure combustor with inlet pressure 800 pounds. We could not go up, we could not go down. And this is uniquely developed combustor which had a lot of restrictions for startup, operation, and so on. In this case, we have no restriction. We can go up and down. We can use a lot of flexibilities, which I will show you a couple slides later. And by the way, I didn't mention, we also have extracted air injection in compressor discharge plenum because combustion turbine with ambient temperature loses capacity. At 95 degree combustion turbine loses 30% of capacity because high temperature reduces density of inlet flow and reduces mass flow through combustion turbine. Therefore, we have power augmentation, which will give us 25% power augmentation at no cost. It's just simple piping. It will give you power augmentation of this combustion turbine. Yeah, what I did not mention also, for smart grid requirements, you can see that this expander's power is controlled only by airflow which is stored. Therefore, we can go up and down within 10 seconds, and out of 227 megawatt, 140 megawatt can go within 10 seconds up and down, meeting regulations and smart grid requirements. In case of you need emergency startup, combustion turbine usually has startup 20, 25 minutes, yeah? But for this reason, we can have duct burner here or here to just preheat air, stored air, which is available, and we're using this only in emergency cases. And then when combustion turbine comes up in power or whatever, we'll have sufficient exhaust heat, we can terminate this and immediately transfer this in normal operation utilizing exhaust gas of combustion turbine. Okay, this is all the same, except power augmentation. We can have exhaust temperature of expander very low. We can use this as inlet air of combustion turbine, which provide combustion turbine practically power augmentation. This is very, it is the same Basin 7FA combustion turbine. The same two slides which I showed you, only higher 7FA combustion turbine results in 440 megawatt. If you go, for example, in Siemens W501D5 combustion turbine, we can have 300 megawatt. But all practically the same flexibility for optimization based on underground storage, based on smart grid requirements, and based on renewable energy. This I show we have right now project for 15 megawatt. 15 megawatt plant, you have underground storage in piping or pressure vessel, and this is much more expensive than underground storage. Therefore, I will show you that we have a lot of flexibility. For example, this optimization starting project resulted in $1,400 per kilowatt, but and a flow of this 47 pounds per second, yeah? Yeah, I'm finishing. Yeah, and we had a number of alternatives. I don't have time to describe, to talk about this, to optimize, to reduce storage size. For example, if we look at this, we use humidified air, which reduces airflow from the storage, which did not affect overall power, but reduced storage significantly, and so on, yeah? Let me go operational requirements during part load operation, heat rate. You see up to 40% load, which is practical operational day. We have the same heat rate. This is energy ratio. This is regulation. Within 10 seconds, you can go from 100% to 40% load, controlling bottoming cycle. This is startup. Using this duct burner, we can start bottoming cycle within 2-3 minutes. Combustion turbine comes in 20 minutes, and then we're running them. And I'm finishing. Cost estimate. I hope you will have access to this. But based on our cost estimate, our project, approximately $1,000 per kilowatt based on 8-hour storage. It means we have 400 megawatt to 20 megawatt and above ground storage. And this is, we have partnership with Mann Diesel Turbo. They have huge expertise in compressed energy storage. They were involved in Hunter project. And you will read this. We have good reason for our cooperation, and we will deliver all above ground based on the requirements of customer, whatever you will ask. If you need a PC contract, we'll be working for a PC contract. If not, we'll deliver project like we delivered the Alabama project. And I have a couple slides on this is summary. that we have ranges from 100 to 500 megawatt, all standard of shell components. This is cost, this is heat rate, extremely low emissions, 2-3 ppm if you combine exhaust of combustion turbines, exhaust of expanders. And the project will be delivered by joint venture Man Diesel Turbo and Energy Storage and Power. You will see on the back, I will not spend time, a description of our patented adiabatic concept, which has CASE technology without any fuel burning, with slightly higher capital cost. And you will find this cycle, and I don't have time to describe this. And they skip. Thank you very much.
Let's see. The third talk this morning will be given by Steve Hickey from Redflow Limited, and he will talk about systems integration strategies for the 10-kilowatt-hour Redflow zinc-bromine battery. Steve.
Morning, ladies and gentlemen. Thanks very much for the opportunity to give you this presentation. What I'm going to give you here is partly travelogue, and it's a bit of a history of how Redflow have managed to put their new technology in the field. There's several projects I want to talk about. And what you can see on the first slide here is a massive solar panel array. It's at the University of Queensland. I'll be referring to that later on. And here we go. So first of all, I want to just give you a précis of the talk. For those of you who haven't seen our system before, what we call the ZBM or ZBM in this country. Then there's a list of projects to go through there, and acronyms you don't need to know about right now. And so the ZBM, zinc-bromine module, it's a redox flow battery. You can see in the image there, I've got a good point here now. The stack on the top that says three, there's actually two in that picture. Tank down below, that's got 90 liters of electrolyte. We got some pumps on the right-hand side there for the circulation. We've got a heat exchanger to manage the cooling. These are approximate dimensions, less than a meter across, and 230 kilos approximately. Oh, and you go back. Oh, yeah. No, I'm with it. Okay, and some specifications. The three key pointers we need to talk about are a 5-kilowatt capacity, 10 kilowatt hours of energy, 240 amp hours, and a gross DC efficiency of 75%. You can see in the top left here of the picture the discharge curves. That's for battery 67, was last year, a two-stack battery, and we're going from 120 amp discharge over 2 hours, so that's about a 5-kilowatt rate, right up to the other end there, which is only 13 amps, and you can see the different voltages. Over on the other side here, I've got a Puket curve for those who you know your lead-acid batteries. I'm comparing a nominal 350 amp-hour lead-acid battery with our nominal 240 amp-hour battery, and I guess the key takeaway message on that slide is if you rate your lead-acid at a 20 amp discharge rate, And then you have to push it up to a higher power delivery, we compare very favorably with a 350 amp hour battery. Okay, what we have to do with a new technology is use the existing equipment around the place, and the lead acid is pretty ubiquitous. So we're talking about hybrid systems, and there can actually be some advantages to having a hybrid system, and that's what I'm trying to get at on this slide. The issues for a lead-acid battery are inherently they want to be charged all the time. They don't like being discharged. And the more often or the deeper the discharge, the more frequent you discharge them, you're curtailing the life. By contrast, the ZBM is best cycled. It inherently starts off discharged and you can use the full capacity charge, but you need to discharge it occasionally. And that's what I've tried to get at in the slide here, a little bit of lead acid discharge, but a lot of zinc bromine cycling combined together is a better hold system. But it's a bit difficult. You can't just go and plug together a zinc bromine and a lead acid battery. You've got to have some strategy for dealing with the relationship between the two. And that's essentially the design issue that we've confronted in all these different projects I want to show you. And here's some of the strategies for dealing with that connection. When you join the two batteries together, you can deal with the excess current that flows, or you can actually modulate the voltages so that there isn't a difference between them, is one strategy. Or you can put a regulator in between to manage the current flow. So here's the travelogue part. This will probably be all new to you. We come from Australia. Brisbane is our hometown. And so we've got some, the first project was nearby, Magnetic Island up on the Coral Coast near Townsville, and just west of Brisbane, a few hours, a couple of sites there. And so these are some of the installations at like farmhouses. I guess what you would describe this as a fringe of grid or a poor grid situation. And so the utility is wanting to support the it's a swirl line out there. So there are actually 30 sites in this project, and I'll show you inside one of these enclosures. We've got two of the ZBMs in there combined with some lead acid batteries. So click here. So this is the reference design, the first thing that we made. I guess it's pretty straightforward. I got a simple diagram here. You've got grid, you've got the SMA inverter, and a lead acid battery bank. So it's a nominal 5 kilowatt sunny backup. And so that's paralleled over here in what we call a grid boss system. And you can see the inverter there and the lead acid nestled down below. And I mean, you might say, well, that's not much of a challenge, or we've put a system inside a box. That's true. What we've also done here that you don't see is that we've incorporated a control system. We've got a cellular link to the system, and significantly, we've got our own microprocessor system buried in there, and we've got remote control over the SMA, so we can tell it what to do in terms of charge and discharge and monitor what's going on. So that's the reference design, the starting point. Now we want to bring in our zinc bromine modules and bring them into the picture. And so again, we've got the grid, the inverter, the lead acid system on the DC bus, and here's our zinc bromine module. And somehow we've got to put a switch in there and control the power flow between the systems. Over here you can see the enclosure. And that's what it looks like inside. Sort of open up pop the bonnet on this one, the hood. And the lead acid in the front and two zinc bromine modules behind it there. And this is a little bit technical, complicated slide, but this is what happens. There was data that's come over the cellular link on a few different parameters, a charge-discharge cycle of the system. And I'm pointing out a few of the features. There's your lead acid voltage. It's a 48 volt system nominal, so it's sitting around 54 volts there the whole time. This is our zinc bromine module being charged. There's some current going in, the voltage of the zinc bromine, and that's the state of charge. So in this case, we're only putting in 150 amp hours. It's not a full charge. Then we stop charging and it floats for a little bit there, the current zero. Then we close the connection between the two, close that switch. And what we're relying on here is the SMA's inherent capability of doing what's described as an overflow grid feed. So I relate the SMA to somewhat like a mother hen sitting on its nest of eggs, being the lead acid batteries. And it's trying to make sure that those lead-acid batteries are always kept in the right conditions. In this case, what it's going to do is when it sees that extra current coming into the lead-acid, the voltage bus, the DC bus, it exports it as AC power onto the grid. And so that's what's happening here. There's the AC power going onto the grid. And this is the current spike coming out of the zinc-bromine module. And as the state of charge falls in the lead-acid, in the zinc-bromine module, so does the amount of current delivery. And I'm not going to explain all of this except to say that if you look at the characteristics, you can actually calculate how much current is going to come out there. And the key parameter is the internal resistance of the zinc-bromine battery. It's much higher than the lead-acid, and that's what determines how much current's going to flow between the two systems. So this is the next project I want to show you, the next bit of the travelogue. This one's an off-grid application, and you may be aware that down in southern Australia, in Victoria, there's a lot of forest there, and every year, pretty much, they have bushfires down there. And the motivation here from Energy Safe Victoria was in some of those fires were actually started by trees hitting the power lines, and so they felt duty-bound to try and explore ways to eliminate that risk. And so one way is to get rid of the grid altogether. And so they chose 10 sites, and we were chosen to put in domestic power for these households. And I should say, if you're looking for a challenging project to test your new technology on, it's supplying domestic power to households, particularly because they've been used to the amenity of power coming out of the line, out of the wall plug, and they don't change their behaviour. They don't think anything's different, that they're now relying on a automated system. So, again, these have communication, cellular link, and you can see some of the examples there. It's certainly a wonderful experience to be involved with the householders there. You can see the big dog there at ESV number 3. The chap here is a very attractive installation. Very friendly guy, apple orchard in this case. So there are some of the installations, and this next slide shows you what the ingredients are. That's a 5 kilowatt, 4.8 kilowatt PV array, and underneath that we've got these two modules. That one's got the diesel in, the Yanmar 7 kilowatt diesel, and in here we've got pretty much the same geometry that I showed you before. There's two ZBMs in there and 300 amp hour lead acid, so it's a hybrid system. On the pole there is a PowerPoint tracker. So that's one of the 10 systems, been running since late last year, and this sort of explains how it gets all connected together. It's, I think, somewhat of a hydraulic analogy I've tried to show here, how the energy flows between the parts of the system. At the left-hand side, you've got the PV generating the power. At the far end and down the hill is the domestic load. So there's a direct connection between the panels and the load, and a good amount of the power can flow along that path. If the load's satisfied, the next place for the power to go is into to the lead acid batteries here. That's the next lowest sink, I guess, in the system. But if the load's satisfied and the lead acids are charged, the next place for the power or the energy to go into is into the zinc bromine modules. And what we've done is with these PowerPoint trackers, set up an intermediate bus that suits the zinc bromine chemistry voltage, and that's where we're essentially storing the extra power or energy available from the solar panels here. And then the reverse is true. The first place for the power to come from is the zinc bromine, and once they're drained, then we're actually discharging the lead acid batteries. Excellent. Here's an image of some of the data from that. There's a lot on there. What I can point out, here's when they're having a cup of tea during the day and their load. Here's some of those cloudy days, charging the zinc bromine battery. You can see the lead acid, the PowerPoint trackers managing the lead acid voltage there, state of charge of our zinc bromines. And so what I said before about the zinc bromine, that's the lead acid state of charge there. That's the zinc bromine. So you could see what I said before about the cycling. This is one of the reports we give for that system. The red's the diesel power, the blue's the solar power, and so that's two of the households, the day of the week and weeks in the month as part of our reporting system to the ESV organization. The next one here is, I mentioned the solar panel at the start. There's some of it on the roof, and we've got our batteries inside the standard shipping container. Everyone's got to have a shipping container or they're not in the race. So this is our entry. And you can see inside the container there, it's quite a nice little office space and some inverters on the wall. I'll show you what that looks like. It's a three-phase system. Again, it's a hybrid, although in this case, we're not actually cycling the lead acid. We're controlling the zinc bromine's current through the DC to DC converters. I should say PowerPoint trackers in this case. Maximum PowerPoint tracker does the power limiting. And lastly, this one's now we've eliminated the lead acid in our latest design, where it's a pure ZBM module inside the enclosure. We're doing 60 of these in Newcastle. We're for a smart grid project, an inverter in the top there. And we're also, and that's what that looks like. So we've got rid of the lead acid, and we've done some customized control system for the SMA. That's what the cycle looks like. In terms of AC power to charge the system, 18 kilowatts, and we've got 10 kilowatts coming out there. 4 kilowatts for 2 hours in that system. And the next scale, we're going to what we call a power tower. So we're putting six systems like that together to make a three-phase system. That's going to be our next container. And lastly, I'd like to thank Imre Gook for his contribution. He didn't actually fund this project, but he is funding some of our testing of the battery at Sandia in the next couple of weeks and months. So thanks very much for that. Thank you.
Presented by Matt Lazarevitz from the Beacon Power Corporation. And Matt will speak about managing the state of charge of energy storage systems used for frequency regulation.
Well, thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here. And you'll be seeing some of the information that's really hot off the press. Some of it's just a few days old. So we'll be lucky to see that, I think. It will be. How do we turn this thing on? There we go. That just says we have lawyers. But we'll be talking about we'll be talking a little bit about Beacon, some of the regulatory issues. We'll be talking quite a bit about that. And also quite a bit about what the data actually is from our first system running in New York. I'll also talk a little bit about the second one that's in process for in Pennsylvania. Okay, basically what we do is we make flywheel-based systems for regulation. We have our first 20-megawatt plant in operation in New York. It's been. It started being online in January 18th and went to full capacity in June. Now this was funded by $43 million loan guarantee from the Department of Energy, and had $2 million from NYSERDA. So NYSERDA has been very big help in this thing as well. I can't believe my cell phone is on. And the second one is a 20 megawatt plant. In Hazeltown, Pennsylvania, that one has a $24 million recovery award grant and a $5 million grant from the state of Pennsylvania. This picture down here is not a rendering. That's actually what the plant looks like in New York. Just a very brief thing for how this plant is basically constructed. Its basic idea is a flywheel. It stores 100 kilowatts for 15 minutes. There's a rotating drum here of carbon and glass composites. There's a hub in here that connects that to a shaft that has a motor attached to it. The whole thing is suspended on magnetic bearings and runs in a vacuum for low power loss. So it's a very, very fast system, very accurate. It has probably 125,000 cycle life, 100% depth of discharges at full power, and it has also basically zero emissions on it. Zero emissions. Now, the way we go from this 100 kilowatt system, we put 10 of them together. Each one of these is a water pipe that contains the flywheels inside of it. It's available everywhere in the world. It's a very stable way to hold the flywheels mounted. The electronics are in this container, and basically there's a little bit of stuff in here for really hot days. Sometimes we have a little bit of cooling going on here as well. Once we have this as a 1 megawatt module, we put 20 of those together into a 20 megawatt plant. So it's a modular built up type of a system. Okay, now a little bit about fast regulation is the conventional generators are required to chase the loads. So for example, if we went to 20 megawatts, the generator has 5 minutes to get there. So the amount of energy that it can deliver is just the area under the curve. Here's how much energy you can. So a generator that can deliver 20 megawatts will only deliver about that much. If you have a storage device, and that's basically any storage device that can respond instantly within a few seconds, you will get something that looks like this. So just by the very nature of being able to respond quickly, you can get up to twice the amount of energy of shoving around for balancing purposes. And what this does is a fast system reaches the goal quickly for where you want to be in power. It does it accurately, and it also, the other benefit is that when you need to redispatch it in the other direction, you can do it immediately. You don't have to wait for 5 minutes for it to come back down again. Okay, now one of the things about the market rules here has been that a storage is not a generator, it's not a load. A generator, you measure the output of it, and then you regulate the output. And load, you just look at the load and you move the load by demand response. Storage is something in between, and what's found is that needs to be managed not by as a generator or as a load, but as a storage device, which is, so you manage it by the state of charge. It's a separate asset class. Now, FERC did is back in 2007, it set the stage for saying thou shalt allow other technologies to participate in ancillary services. The ISOs all really came to the party, and they all came up with the ways for how to actually go do that. So New York, Midwest, ISO, and PJM are basically, they're open right now. New England has a program that's in development, and CAISO has one for review by PJM. Now FERC is now saying, let's go. Why don't we go ahead one step forward and go for pay for performance, which means that if you can do twice as good a job and change the imbalance twice as well, you should get paid twice as much. So this pay for performance agenda has been on since January or February of this year, and we're expecting and it's on the docket for tomorrow for approval. So hopefully tomorrow we'll have very good news to say that there will be a mandate to pay for performance, and all ISOs will be required or RTOs will be required to conform. Now, the reason why they did that is because what this does is it will actually reduce the amount of regulation that you need, because if you have more effective, you don't need to buy as much regulation. They also believe that it will also require less energy for the systems, which will drop the overall system cost, and it also allows the new technologies to actually recover some of their costs. So basically, everybody is a winner on this. Now, if we just take a look at PJM as an example, as we end up with new wind and renewables being entered into the grid, we have this thing about where we will need a lot more regulation. And where is it going to be coming from? And over here on the right, we have a chart that shows this is the percentage of time that we need this amount of regulation. When PJM believes if they add 20% of wind, they'll need something that looks like this. They may need 2 to 3 times as much regulation as what we have today. So their resources really aren't there to do that, or they're very difficult to get, or they'll become much more expensive. So the other ISOs are all drawing the same type of conclusions. When we get to 20 to 30%. Renewables, we will need a lot more regulation. Okay, now, what have we learned? Well, we've got these 200 flywheels that are sitting here running in New York, and they're operating in a plus or minus 20 to 20 megawatt range. And the storage capacity is actually quite small. It's only 5 megawatt hours. It responds in about a four-second type of a time frame. That one plant provides about 20% of the capacity, or 10% of the capacity for the whole state. That's based on the power level. But on the amount of energy that it moves around, it's actually closer to 20 to 40%. And on a daily basis, it actually provides most of the regulation, or a lot of the regulation for New York. The reason why it does that is because this 5 megawatt hour plant, moves around about 100 megawatt hours a day. So that's the real requirement for a storage device is to move 100 megawatt about 5 megawatt hours or 20 I'm sorry 20 megawatt hours that you need for every megawatt hour of capacity has to be moved by the storage device. So basically, it's 20 equivalent full cycles a day, and if you have different states of charge or discharge or whatever, or depths of discharge, then you have or C rates, then you can whatever it takes to do that. This is the chart that shows if you have what the regulation actually was in New York. This is the signal that the storage device has been getting. The red one is what a generator, 5-minute red generator, would be getting. When you look at that, you can see the difference between the blue and the kind of the purple side to it. That's how much energy difference there is. In this particular case, there was about a factor of 3 difference in the amount of correction that was actually made. So in this case, with the new structure, we would expect to be paid about three times as much, and by today's standard, everybody gets paid the same amount. Okay, now, just yesterday we completed the 100-hour qualification test, and it's a requirement for all regulation resources by New York ISO, and it's also an element of the loan guarantee program. The results are under review now in New York since it really only came yesterday, so we can't say that we've completed it yet quite yet. Now, we did have some flywheel failures in the process of this. We've had 2, one in July and one in October, which is just last week. Now basically the isolation systems that the containment systems for the flywheels worked very well and they performed as expected. There was no damage to any adjacent wheels. There was no fire. There were no toxic cleanup that was required for anything. The system was actually under test at the time for the 100-hour test, on last week's run, and basically the plant continued operating without stopping or slowing down or anything else, continuing to deliver the 20 megawatts of regulation power. So that was really a great news story. The failure investigation is still in process, but basically the biggest issue is that if you have a flywheel failure, there is no impact on the operation of the grid, of the plant. In PJM, okay, we're going through the permitting process, but there's a recent code change that happened that changed some of the stormwater retention requirements, and so that's going to slow us down a bit, because we are expecting it to be ready to start construction uh, in the, in the, uh, you know, well, right about now, but we're going to have to wait until early part of next year in order to get that all done. So we've retained consulting company to actually figure out how to do this without having to require more and more and more area, or come up with waivers or something. So this is just it's a bit of a setback for us. All the interconnection things are underway. The Pennsylvania Power issued the interconnection and construction agreements. The plant financing is in the process of being worked, and we're expecting it to be in operation by the end of next year. Okay, so where are we in PJM as far as they're using the pay-for-performance type of things? The pay-for-performance new ruling is that in 2008-2009, PJM redeveloped a new signal to take advantage of the faster rate of speed. In 2010, what they did is they created a new energy storage category. It was approved by FERC. Right now, they have a task force operating that'll reflect what's actually going to be coming out of the FERC ruling. Hopefully come out tomorrow, it'll allow the system to get paid. To get paid for what it's worth. Their next meeting is on November 16th. Expect that to vote there at that point, and we expect that to be actually implemented early next year. So basically where we are is when we're including all these new systems, all these new clean generation systems, why do we want to regulate it with something that looks more like that? We really want to make it look something that looks a little bit cleaner that way. I think we've had a lot of very good experience here in this particular project and program.
I would remind all of you to please wait for the floor mics to arrive when you ask your questions so the audience can hear you, and please identify yourself. So, questions. Here in the middle, back in the back. Let's start back in the back. Go ahead.
Question on compressed energy storage to Mike Nagamkin. Appreciated your presentation. I was curious to get your opinion on the price in dollars per kW for the Alabama plant versus what you expect the prices to be today for that same technology, and particularly discuss contingencies and indirects and things of this nature.
Do you hear me?
It works?
Yes or no? Yes.
Okay, I'm sorry. Alabama project had then cost $600 per kilowatt. We had underground storage for 26 hours. And balance above ground equipment represented approximately 35% cost, underground storage $6 million, 10% cost, and balance of plant equipment, including in underground storage, above ground storage, completion of project on EPC basis was 45%. And it right now we have different payments, it means 20 years past, but I think percentage should be the same. And second generation of CAES technology, much, much simpler from point of view of delivery as compared to Alabama project. We have skid-mounted components which could be easily installed, delivered. We don't have six components like Alabama project had, which were operating. I'm sorry, six, eight components, which twice a day they were operating all together with eight components have different critical speed. It means we spent 6 months on construction of this only turbo machinery train. Therefore, in our case, we don't spend any time because it's skid-mounted components. Therefore, I believe that it should be on relative scale cheaper, but prices right now are higher.
Thank you.
Okay, here in the middle of the room.
Okay, Jim Iyer here. This is for Matt. Matt, what's the change-out time on a flywheel? And I assume you keep one around as a backup. I have three quick questions here. Do you guys do any oversizing, either on energy or power, on your plant? And then what's the penalty if you don't perform?
The question is what is the time frame to change a flywheel? This first one or the second one is still in the process of being changed out. We expect it very very shortly. It's like less than, and in this particular case it'll be about a week or so to do that. But typically take one flywheel in and out is about a 20-minute process. The other one was. Oversizing, the system does have oversize capability, and it does all the hardware does have margin on it, and this plant does have a fair degree of margin on it itself, so it'll continue operating at 20 megawatts. The third one was, what is the penalty if you don't perform? Right now the way that it is today, you have 5 minutes to get to your point. To the operating point, we can do it in about 4 seconds. So I guess to be consistent with what generators, it'll take. We can be off by quite a bit, but that's not what really happens. There is no real penalty at this point. It's a question of you pass the test, and that's what the 100-hour test was like. If you do that, then you qualify for operations, and then you can get audited along the way for performance. But we're not expecting any issues with performance on this system.
Okay, right up front here.
Axel Peterson, Dong Energy, Denmark. It's a question to the compressed air energy storage. You built a plant in Alabama 20 years ago. It took 2 or 3 years to build. You mentioned a product with the above earth cast 15 megawatts. What will the construction time be for such a project, and do you have plans for such a project anywhere?
Our schedule for project delivery will be not more than 3 years. The same as Alabama project. It could be shorter because, again, we don't have a lot of complications. We don't have to combine 8 components together. It's all skid-mounted components. It could be driven by below-ground storage. Alabama project, they finished storage for 26 hours within 1 year, and they left. Phoenix and Sisson Company. For above-ground, it's practically the same. We're looking at not exceed 3 years. Cost will be much higher because above-ground storage costs much higher. Did I answer your question?
Do
you
have any plans?
Oh, no, we don't have any plans. We're working right now on several, we hope that it will be upcoming projects, yeah? But we don't have signed contract for project delivery. But we have one project for 15 megawatt above ground storage in New York State. But it's small, 15 megawatt.
Okay, over here.
This is Roland Marquardt at RWE, developing adiabatic CAS. And a question to Mr. Nakamkin again. You said that you're using standard components, off-the-shelf components. Are these expanders, what are they used normally for in other applications? And is there a high startup capability proven? And the second question would be, I mean, you have a number of components now, and otherwise you can make use of economic of scales, which you cannot do at the moment, and does that overcompensate?
For adiabatic concept, I think you will find publication in Gas Turbine World describing our technology, adiabatic technology. We have patent for this, and it is based only and only on existing components. We're not looking for increasing compressor discharge temperature from current 800 degree to 1600 degree, which will cost many years. It will be a new component and a lot of money. And we are using all standard components, and it results in, it's like battery. because we don't burn fuel. Therefore, we are delivering 70-75% of stored energy without fuel, without any fuel consumption. And cost estimated will be, right now, we estimated cost at $600 per kilowatt. Thank you.
Any other questions? Okay, well, that will end the morning session. Dan Borneo asked me to announce that lunch will be once again downstairs in the same location. And please join me in thanking each of the speakers for the excellent presentations this morning.